It sounds so corny and I almost hesitate to say it's not a job for me. It's not a job. I absolutely love what I'm doing. I think if I won lotto, I would still be bouncing out of bed and going to Chalice every day. Mm. It's what I love doing. It feels like it brings real purpose to my life. I think it's just so fantastic to be part of something that's much bigger and more important than you are. So what we're doing and what we're creating is important for a community. And I work with a great group of people. I love the children. I love the families.
Welcome back to Herstory. This series gets stuck into the stories of inductees to the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. My name's Taylor Strano. I'm with you each week as we meet some of the trailblazing women who've called WA their home. In episode 9, we meet Lee Musumeci. Lee has revolutionised the way we think about school and education. As the principal of Chalice Community Primary School, Lee, together with the parents and teachers, developed a new education system where families are supporting in educating their children from birth through to adulthood. Her Womb to Workplace program has dramatically impacted students in the best way possible. It's Season 2, Episode 9 of Herstory with Lee Musumeci. This is Her Story.
Hi, my name's Lee Musumeci. I grew up in a very loving home with two parents and a brother and a sister and a pet dog. And I had a blessed childhood. We were raised in the area of Spearwood. I went to Spearwood Primary School for all of my primary schooling and then went off to Hamilton High School.
School is going to be brought up a lot in this conversation. Can you recall your time at school and what that experience was like for you?
I can't recall a lot of primary school. I can recall the key teachers who stood out in my life to make primary school really beautiful, and they were teachers who were warm and caring and loving and genuinely showed an interest in me, so I can recall them very clearly. I can recall some things that didn't go well when I didn't raise my hand and I called out when I was very young and I was growled at. Those sorts of things really stick in your mind, so probably the extremities, people who were very kind or something that I did that led me to being growled at, which stuck in my mind. I was a fairly compliant, shy little girl, so being growled at is something that would have stuck in my mind.
Enthusiastic is a word that was used in my school reports very often. Is that something that was used on yours?
Quiet.
Quiet.
Quiet, yeah. Okay. Quiet achiever. Yeah, quiet.
It's interesting that after all these years, and I know that you work in school now, that you still have those teachers that you do remember, though. And I think a lot of people maybe take away one or two teachers, either through primary or secondary school, that they still have fond memories of.
Definitely. So I can remember Mrs. Bodica. Mrs. Bodica took us on school camp, and she also explained the chicken and the egg concept to us. And she also that was the very first time that she introduced the concept that smoking was dangerous to your health, and my parents had just taken up smoking. So I remember going home and giving them a great big lecture. So Mrs. Bodica is, forever etched in my memory.
That's a really lovely memory. I'm sure people listening are thinking fondly about teachers that have stayed with them in their lives as well. Is it something that you always knew that you wanted to do, or what was the point where you said, I think that I could be a teacher?
For me, I don't have any memory of ever thinking or considering any other profession or career. For me, I wanted to be a teacher from that's my only memory. That's
wow.
There was never a question for me. So I think that was really lucky, because I never went through any angst of I'm not sure what I want to do. Mm. I always knew that that's what I wanted to do. I always wanted to look after children or make sure I was kind to children, so children would have a nice schooling experience, but also make sure that they achieved great grades, so they could have whatever they wanted in their life. So there was no other career choice for me.
Does that come, do you think, from growing up in such a loving sort of environment and having a really positive schooling experience?
It may do. I don't know. There are some teachers in my family, but it's not as though I was completely surrounded by a family of teachers in my extended family. My dad always thought I could be the first female Prime Minister, but I didn't quite make that.
You didn't quite make that, but you've done some pretty incredible stuff, I think, comparable to that, and we'll get to touch on it. Talk to me a bit about the journey to becoming a teacher. You finished high school. Did you go straight through to uni or to teachers' college?
I did. I went straight through to finish my degree. And then once I had done that, I went across to Canada and taught children with disabilities across in Toronto, which is something that I had always wanted to do. I suppose the thing that really helped cement my career path for me was I met a young girl who had cerebral palsy when I was quite young, when I was roughly actually the same age as her. And I was babysitting at the local football club, and I would look after all of the children while the dads were on the footy field and the mums were doing whatever mums do, probably serving in the canteen or whatever they were doing at that point in time. Yeah, selling raffle tickets to raise money for the local footy club. And I can just always remember looking after children, and I came across a little girl who had cerebral palsy, and I can always remember the feeling of being outraged by the inequity and the injustice and the unfairness that I was able to run and jump and play and do cartwheels and somersaults, and she was unable to do that. So I think that probably first started to propel my feelings of social justice and, you know, things aren't fair. We aren't all born equal. We don't all have the same opportunities. And somehow I wanted to try and level the playing field for people.
I love that story. Thank you for sharing it. How old are we talking at this point?
Look, I really can't remember, but I'm thinking I must have been somewhere between 11 and 13.
That's pretty young to be able to pick up on such a broad social justice issue specifically as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that does come from being part of a loving family. We were always raised to make sure we were looking out for people and standing up for what we believe in, even if it's a hard thing to have to do, or even if it's not a popular opinion to hold. But if it's right, you know, make sure that you don't stay quiet. So, you know, always give people a helping hand. So I think that's how we were raised. I think that sort of was the foundation for my thinking.
So moving to Canada to start your first teaching role and to teach children with disability, there's a couple of different things going on there. Had you lived out of the country before?
No, I hadn't.
It's a big step.
It was a huge step. It was I led a pretty safe and, I suppose, sheltered and fortunate life. You know, nothing huge or disruptive occurred in my life. I had a very stable upbringing. Yeah, when I went to Canada, that was a big move, and teaching children with disabilities was the thing I absolutely fell in love with. So when I returned to Perth, my first teaching post here was actually at Princess Margaret Hospital, at the hospital school, where I worked with children who were on the short stay ward. So they'd come in for an operation for something, and they, you know, I still had to connect them with their schooling to make sure that there was no gap in their learning. And then I continued on into the field of disability after that.
We need to talk more about the hospital school. That wasn't something that I was aware that existed.
Oh, it still exists today. Yeah.
That's
so when
incredible.
Children go in for, you know, you might have children who have unfortunately gone in because they have, there's been an accident of some sort and they're going to be in hospital for quite some time, or when they're well enough to start their learning but not well enough to be discharged, the hospital school fills that void for them, so that there's a connection still with their school.
We know that teachers provide an incredibly important service to help educate young people and to give them that structure in their life from Monday to Friday, from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. or whatever it might be. What's something that maybe people don't know about the value and the importance of having teachers and having good teachers at that?
I think probably as a community, we probably completely underestimate the value of teachers and the importance they play in the lives of small children in particular, but also of teenagers. I think we undervalue and don't understand the impact of them. So they are consistent in the lives of the children, and their words are very powerful. So kindness towards children can go a long way, because that's what's remembered. The first thing you asked me was memories about school. I could tell you a kind teacher, but I could also tell you the teacher who growled at me. So I don't think teachers probably understand the impact that they have on children and little people either. So it's, you know, we really have to be very aware and very careful with our words, because it leaves a lasting impact and footprint on a person.
Teachers are like the original influencers.
They are the original influencers. I'll share with you a story that I find semi-funny now. I didn't find it funny at the time, but I have two beautiful children who are the centre of my life. And I can remember my daughter, who's the oldest one, said to me one day, I'd been telling her a certain... We were sitting around the dinner table like we did every night, and I'd been talking to her about a particular... must have been using her manners for something or other. And I had to keep reminding her, like you do with small children. I reminded her each time about whatever the topic was. I can't remember it. And one day she came home and she said, "Mum, guess what? Mrs. whoever the teacher was told us today that..." And she repeated the same thing that I'd been saying for all of this time. And I said, "Oh, that's wonderful. Isn't that great that Mrs. So-and-so, that's what Mummy's been saying for a long time." And she said, "Oh, yeah, but you're just my mum. She's my teacher." And then I thought, oh, okay, I'm now recognising, you know, from the other side of the fence, how important teachers actually are. Mm. And then she quoted the same thing to me when she said that, you know, my teacher told me that. But and I said, yes, I've been telling you the same thing. And she also said, you're just the principal. So teachers need to understand teachers need to understand how impactful they are in the lives of small kids.
Especially in the last couple of years when routine has been thrown out the window. Mm. And we don't need to stay on this topic for too much longer, but as a principal, what was it like running a school during lockdown, not lockdown, distant learning, not distant learning? Mm. What was that like?
Well, I'm glad we're not going to talk about it for very long, but it has been really challenging, really, really difficult. It has been difficult for everybody, for parents, for children, for teachers, and certainly for principals. So I'm very glad that we're moving out of it. It was always the uncertainty. You know, school is quite a certain place. There's a routine. The bell rings at a certain time. Subjects are delivered. There's a routine, a flow and a rhythm to life when you are in school land. Mm. But when you aren't sure whether you're delivering online or not, and you don't know what that looks like, it's just all the uncertainty.
And for a lot of those students, like you mentioned before, about school being a constant in their lives and teachers being a constant in their lives, it's also a place of safety for a lot of kids as well, isn't it?
Well, for the majority of children, especially in, you know, certain areas, that is their safe place. That's why they arrive so early and try to not go home when they're supposed to go home. So, yeah, that sense of safety was shaken for them.
Lee, tell me a little bit about the school that you work at the moment.
I've been at that same school for, I'm going into my 19th year now. Actually, it might even be my 20th year. So it's been a very long time at this school. So, and I can talk for a very long time about it. So I work at Chalice Community Primary School in Armidale. We serve a community that has challenges and disadvantages and a whole pile of strengths as well. It's a large school. It's a level 6 school, so 920 plus children. And we also run a birth to 3 years of age program so that we can give children or babies and toddlers a really great head start from the very, very, very earliest days that we can work with their mums and their carers.
What is it that's unique about Chalice Primary School? Because this is a school that's come about in kind of an interesting way. It's an amalgamation of two separate schools, isn't it?
Mm, it is. So for 11 years, I was the principal of Chalice Early Childhood Education Centre. And at that point in time, that was a kindergarten to year 2 school. And then Chalice Primary School was year 3 through to year 6. And then in 2015, the two schools were amalgamated and became Chalice Community Primary School. Many unique features about it. So we do start working from birth, which is quite different. We have a very successful partnership with Curtin University, which brings all of their fourth year allied health students onto our school premises, which means that they can deliver therapy to our children every day of the week, 40 weeks of the year, which means that there's no wait list for our children to be able to access the kind of therapy that they might need that will complement their learning.
Wow.
That's incredible.
That's massive.
It's massive, yeah. We have a very important and influential and effective music program whereby we can provide instruments to children free of charge, and we have been very successful in securing a number of grants to be able to organise their tuition also free of charge. We have an instrumental program that creates orchestras for the children. So from a young age, they are exposed to a full array of music tuition.
I want to talk more about music in a moment, but let's go back to the early childhood. It's this concept that you've named, it's womb to workplace.
Oh.
Is that correct?
Yeah, so that is the strategy that I've been working on for about 5 years, maybe 6 years now. So the concept is that in a disadvantaged community, people and families require support, and short-term support isn't going to be impactful or effective. So we need to take a long-term view of human development if we really want to make sure that people have the first 18 years of their life in the most supportive environment possible, which will set them up for a good life of hope and optimism and happiness and choice and independence and ultimately freedom and giving back to the community. The alternative to that is that we don't provide a joined up service for people. They fall through the gaps. They might get some things that they need, but not everything to be truly happy and fulfilled as people. And then that leads to cracks later on. And it can also lead to them not having their needs met. If you don't meet the needs of people, they aren't able to be, you know, the best version of themselves, which ultimately isn't good for society. So we're trying to raise happy, healthy people with great choices in their life.
It's so interesting because when you talk about this idea, a lot of it is future-proofing, and it's for talking about these ideas of when people are adults, being able to be effective and nice contributing members of society. But we're talking about little children here when we really get down to the business of it. It's such an interesting concept because children are children and they don't really know necessarily about some of the things that could potentially inhibit them from being able to achieve X, Y, and Z. So to have a concept like that and to have a strategy implemented in a school, I imagine the community around you and the students that are being sent to this primary school are incredibly grateful for it.
They are. Our families do appreciate everything that is provided at the school. And I think whether they do or don't understand what we're trying to achieve, they are incredibly grateful. I think the concept is that we know a couple of things. We know that people need to learn to read. Learning to read is really important, and that closes a lot of doors if you can't read, if you're struggling with your reading. So from a young age, we are making sure that all teachers understand how to teach children to read most effective manner. We know that people need to socialise and play and learn to get along with one another, so focusing on their social skills and helping them to understand how to behave in certain situations is super important, and making sure they have some other foundational type skills that are going to lead them to being able to make better choices when they go to high school and better choices when they then graduate from high school is really important.
Can you tell us a bit about the community? When you say that you're doing all this work to help serve the community around Chalice Primary School, who are the community? Can you tell us a bit about those people?
Yeah, that's a really good question because I think sometimes people aren't quite sure who I'm talking about. I'm really just talking about the community we serve are the families of the children who attend our school. So I'm just simply talking about the mums and dads and the blended families and the families of our school. So anyone who belongs to Chalice is the community that we are serving, and we try to meet their needs. So we have, grandparents who are the sole carers of their children. So we try to do things with grandparents. We have fly-in, fly-out families. We have single families. We have dads raising their kids by themselves. We have very young mums with no support. We have mums and dads in the same household doing an excellent job who just want to learn more. So it's anyone who is associated with our school.
Does it require, I guess, a level of buy-in from parents to be engaged in the programming or the way that the school is run?
Absolutely. All the research in the world will say that the more that the parents are involved and engaged in school, the better the outcomes for children. I think that our parents engage with our school really well, really, really well. They're appreciative and they generally want to know more. I think like all parents, you always want better for your own children than you had for your own life. We're all trying to improve things for the next generation. So I think they're just genuinely trying to understand how they can help support their children at home so they can be fantastic at school.
I don't imagine that you identify yourself, Lee, as a disruptor, because I don't think that that's what you've done or what you're trying to do here. But what you have done is introduce a whole different way of approaching things, a different idea and concept of how you teach, because it's not just in the classroom, it's a holistic approach. It's wonderful. When you first started to introduce these ideas and get teachers on board, and we'll talk about the teaching side of it in a moment, what was the reaction like? Was everybody in from the get-go, or were there people that weren't quite sure about what it was that you were trying to do?
Oh, I think there were people along a spectrum of sort of acceptance or understanding, and I was exactly the same. I never knew from the very beginning that what we were going to do was going to work or that it was even right, but I understood that what we had been doing for a number of years wasn't working. So no one wants to lead a school that continues to turn out poor results. So if what you're doing isn't working, then the obvious thing is to look to do something different. And as long as you're putting in a strategy that has a strong research base, you can lead people towards change. Did they all accept it from the very beginning? No. No.
I want to talk a bit about how the school actually operates. The system that you've put in place is an interesting one because for 920-odd children, it's a lot of energy and a lot of teachers that are required to teach those kids as well. The way that it runs in your school, though, is a little bit different. You have leaders in each year level. Can you talk us through what the idea is behind that?
You've done some good research. We do. So many, many years ago, I set out to achieve implemented three broad strategies. The first one was I needed to do something to improve what was happening for toddlers before they came to school. So they had more school readiness skills because they weren't ready for school. So we developed the Parenting Centre, and that's one huge 0 to 3 service. And that's very generously supported by the Mindaroo Foundation. So that's one huge strategy. The next thing that I did was focus on ensuring that we had high quality teaching happening in classrooms every day of the week. So that was a huge strategy around developing the professional learning and the capacity of teachers to teach in the way that research says is the most effective. And the third strategy was on putting in a distributed leadership model so that none of the success of the school was tied up in just one person. And that's the distributed leadership model that we have in school, which is incredible and is the driving force behind the success of the school. So what that means in real terms is we might have, say, 5 or 6 classes per year level. So every year level has a lead teacher who is responsible for coordinating the planning, the teaching, the learning that occurs in that year level. And then between 2 year levels, there is an impact coach. So teachers have coaches who come into their classrooms and help them to work on a particular goal, an improvement goal, and give them feedback on that goal. And then they work on whatever the next goal might be. So it's about continual improvement and enhancing the quality of teaching that's occurring and making sure that every child has a great teacher. We're not looking at having, you know, I think I have 6 year one classes. I don't want one year one teacher who's brilliant and the rest who are struggling. That's not good for all kids. So the role of the impact coach is to make sure that all teachers are given the support and the feedback they need to be fantastic.
Do any other schools operate like this?
Yes, I'm sure there are many, many, many schools. Coaching has become a very common thing to do now in education. We've been doing it for a very long time and we've just got better at it, evolving sort of the model that we use. But yes, teachers are being coached in other schools.
All of these initiatives and these plans are amazing. In one way or another, it does come down to funding and money. And you've done a really interesting way of going about achieving these goals. Can you talk us through a bit about, you know, don't reveal your finances, please. but it's quite an interesting way that you've gone about it. You mentioned that the Mindaroo Foundation. I can't imagine there are many other schools that are approaching Mindaroo and saying, this is a concept that we want to implement. Can you help us?
Look, I've been really fortunate over so many years because what we've been doing has been going on for a very long time. There's been stable leadership. There's a stable narrative at school around what we're trying to achieve. So it has been in the early days, it was actually relatively easy for us to be able to attract funding from people who wanted to support the school. It has become much more difficult because schools more and more now are turning to philanthropy to try and create additional opportunities for children over and above what our budget generally is to be used for. So it was much easier a long time ago. Now it's much more difficult to attract funds. So it's just around making sure we're using our money smartly. So there's no fat in our budget. There's nothing that we are doing that doesn't return an outcome for children. And it's about being really quite clinical and clear about what's going to have an impact and what won't. Because everything you do is fun. Kids enjoy, you know, a whole smorgasbord of opportunities that we could provide and a whole pile of fun that we could provide, but there's only a limited amount of money. So we have to work out, where are we going to place our money? It's almost like placing a bet. Where are we going to place our money that's going to give us the biggest return on that investment for the sake of the children? And coaching, putting our money into coaching, is one of those big bets.
I want to, like, give you my finances and say, can you work on a budget for me, please? Because I think you'd be really good at it. I imagine your home budget.
This doesn't transfer to my home budget.
I don't know. I reckon if I gave you mine, they're simple. I don't have none of mortgage payments. It should be easy.
How many lattes are you having a day?
Yeah, we'll see. This is the problem. It's not the lattes. It's the dumplings.
Right. Okay. Well, there might be some ability to trim some things there.
Maybe I won't give you the finances. Tell me about your music program.
Okay, so I was approached by the most wonderful, wonderful lady who gave me the opportunity to be involved in a music program. I've always wanted music in our school. We've never had money, or I've never chosen to use our budget to fund a music program. We've always used a lot of our budget on making sure children know how to read. Music I always saw as sort of the icing on top of the cake, and we didn't quite have the ingredients of the cake right at that point in time, so we weren't ready to branch out into music. music, we were approached by a wonderful lady by the name of Celia Tate, who runs Artemis Productions, and she gave me the opportunity to take on a music program. And she was going to document our progress over a series of about 18 months, which then turned into the documentary on the ABC called Don't Stop the Music. And I am just so happy to be able to let you know that even though the cameras have gone and they left many years ago, our music program has been sustained. And we now have hundreds of children who are in various orchestras and bands at school and provide the most wonderful accompaniment to every assembly and every special event that we have because we've been able to give them this opportunity. So initially, the program was supported by Guy Sebastian and James Morrison, who came across to Perth, supported us at school on many occasions. We had Anita Collins, who was the first person who really, I suppose, helped us to understand the impact that music has on brain development. Celia was able to bring all of these wonderful people together, impactful people together, to help showcase the importance of music on brain development and actually the importance of music on helping children to read, similar areas of the brain lighting up. And our program is still going. This is a program that is a struggle for funding because it is typically seen as something that either I fund through the school budget, which we're not able to do. There's hundreds of children doing the program now, so that's it is quite costly. So we do require grants or philanthropy for that to continue, and it is absolutely worth every cent. The way the children see themselves is completely different once they become part of a band and they see themselves as part of a team or a group. The enjoyment that it brings, the happiness that it brings, the entertainment that it brings, it's the most magnificent program that we have running in school.
It's that classic thing of more than just the literal, you get an instrument, you learn how to play and read music. There's so much more included in that, isn't there?
So much more. There are children who have stepped up and have become leaders who have never identified themselves as leaders in the past, but they are band leaders and they take responsibility for setting up any of the performances, packing away the performances, making sure everybody has their sheet music. They see themselves as part of a team. They have the opportunity to give something a go that they may not have even known the name of in the past. You know, some of our children may not have known the name of some of the instruments, and now they're actually playing, they're playing them.
Yeah, what a sense of pride as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
In sync, that's great.
In sync, you know, and it doesn't sound like screeching cats. It's great. But now the music program has sort of reached a point where we have performances whereby the choir, the strings orchestra and the brass band all play in harmony. You know, I don't know anything about music. I've always said that. I just know when it sounds awful and what I love. That's, you know, that's, I just love singing along to stuff. Can't sing either. But anyway, but I know when it sounds great. But to be part of an assembly or any kind of event at school and you have the choir, a brass band, strings, beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
That is a far departure from my Year 7 recorder ensemble. Which, yes, did sound like screaming cats. Yes, thank you for bringing up that fond childhood memory for me. You've been a teacher for a number of years now, coming up on 2 decades at Chalice alone. What are some of the biggest changes that you've seen that you've not been involved in teaching?
Well, as far as the Department of Education is concerned, the launch of Independent Public Schools Initiative was one of the biggest ones. That was absolutely fantastic back in 2010, and that allowed primary schools who chose to do so to become independent, to sort of reach that status, and that allowed us to have far more flexibilities than we'd had in the past. So that was a really key movement. There's a far greater emphasis on the importance of early childhood now than what there used to be a number of years ago. I think early childhood, back when I first started, and remember I was the principal of the Chalice Early Childhood Education Centre, I think early childhood wasn't as valued as it is now. I think people thought that we played in sandpits and, you know, rolled Play-Doh, and the real learning actually started when the kids hit, you know, year 3, 4, 5, 6 and were doing WALNA back then, which is called NAPLAN now. I think there is a far greater understanding that those early years are actually the foundation for future learning and for future problems. So if they're not identified early and remediated early, the problems exist and continue and grow larger. So I think there's a far greater importance on making sure that all little children who are going to school or who are in daycare or, you know, childcare arrangements have access to high quality teachers who really value and understand the importance of early childhood.
What keeps you going, Lee? I mean, you've been doing this for such a long time now. You would have met and I'm sure impacted the lives of so many families, students and teachers. What is the thing now in 2023 that will keep you getting up and going back to school this year?
It sounds so corny and I almost hesitate to say
it. Go on,
but
say it.
It's not a job for me. It's not a job. I absolutely love what I'm doing. I think if I won lotto, I would still be bouncing out of bed and going to Chalice every day. Mm. It's what I love doing. It feels like it brings real purpose to my life. I think it's just so fantastic to be part of something that's much bigger and more important than you are. So what we're doing and what we're creating is important for a community. And I work with a great group of people. I love the children. I love the families. So I don't need much for me to bounce out of bed and go to work every day because I love what I do. Mm. Absolutely love it. So intrinsically, that's just what I want to do.
It seems to love you right back. I want to touch on just a few of the things that you've been recognised for and recognised with over the years. In 2010, awarded the WA Primary Principal of the Year. The following year, the Australian Primary Principal of the Year, and in the Community Award category for the 2019 West Australian of the Year. I know that you'll just say that they come with the job, and I know that you won't necessarily maybe identify yourself as this huge, great community champion, but it clearly speaks volumes about the people that you work with day to day.
Look, I've had the most fortunate life and the most fortunate career. So I just feel like I have been awarded, awards, and I've received acknowledgement when really there's been a lot of people around me who have supported me and given me the opportunity, and I've just been the lucky one to be the figurehead that receives the acknowledgement. I'm incredibly grateful for all of it, but that's not why I'm doing what I do.
We know it's not why you do what you do, but it is nice to be recognised from your community sometimes. And that's also what happened in 2019 with the West Australian Women's Hall of Fame. Did you know prior to this that we had a Hall of Fame for women?
I did not. I'm embarrassed to say I did not.
Look, you're not the only one, and that's totally fine. But you were inducted. What was it like getting the phone call to say, hello, we would like to put you in our Hall of Fame?
Complete and utter disbelief. Complete and utter disbelief. First of all, I had to research who else is in the Women's Hall of Fame and where is it and what does it actually mean, and oh my goodness, that there's been a mistake, that I'm not going into Women's Hall of Fame.
There are not that many Lee Musumeci's around, I can guarantee you.
No, the name Musumeci's a bit different. So absolute disbelief, and then I suppose I always feel awkward and embarrassed, to be honest. Yeah, I probably still suffer from imposter syndrome. I don't deserve to be in the same Hall of Fame as the other brilliant women who are in there. So, yeah, I always feel awkward and uncomfortable. I feel awkward and uncomfortable now.
You've done a great job today, and I'm sure that if we spoke to any of your past students or teachers or families, they would totally disagree with you. Before we let you go, Lee, just a few final questions for you. What is the focus for you in 2023 for teaching and for schools in general?
Straight up for my school, it's to make sure every child can read. So we are on an absolute mission to make sure that we're tightening up on the way we teach children to read so that they are indeed readers. And then secondly, I need to keep working really hard on fleshing out the womb to the workplace strategy. So my next focus is on connecting with our local high schools so that when our children leave primary school, we move over to a high school who continues to work in the same way that we are.
I'm sure this isn't the last that we'll hear from you this year. But until then, Lee, thank you very much for being part of Herstory.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to Lee Musumeci and all the women at the WA Women's Hall of Fame. And thanks to the incredible women who make Herstory happen. Our executive producer is Danae Gibson. Sophie Minisale and Madeline Lombardi are our assistant producers. Emily Jane Reid is our production assistant. Our theme music is an original composition from Annika Moses with artwork from Peter Roebuck. Herstory is an RTRFM podcast series about women in the Western Australian Women's Hall of Fame. This podcast is produced on Whadjuk Noongarrbuja. RTRFM acknowledges and pays respects to the Aboriginal elders of this land, past and present. These lands were never ceded. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find out more at cbf.org.au. My name's Taylor Strano. Join us next week when we meet the woman whose calling for the stage led her to a life of capturing everyone's stories.
From UFO sightings to abandoned theme parks and tank rampages across the CBD, Planet Perth is your guide to the weird, wacky and unexplained history of our eccentric city. Planet Perth. Stream now on iTunes, Spotify and rtrfm.com.au.